So Mr. Harris, could you introduce our new State Water Board family member?
Yes, Kurt Souza from the New Drinking Water Division is here today, and as you all have, I want to extend a welcome to Mr. Souza. He's not new to our staff. He's worked. He's worked with our staff for many years. He's working with us on Cambria, and we're certainly happy to have the drinking water program with us. So with that, I'll let Mr. Souza say hello and tell you a little bit about what he does. He's based here in Santa Barbara, but he manages a number of offices also in the LA region too. So with that, Mr. Souza.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. After all the updates and stuff, most of my numbers have already been thrown out, but I'll go through them quickly for you. My name is Kurt Souza. I'm the Southern California Section Chief of the Division of Drinking Water. I'm located in the Santa Barbara District Office. I've been with the Drinking Water Program for 25 years, and I oversee what's called Region 4. It includes San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and LA counties. And I know there's a map in your package, which I'll go over in a second. The Drinking Water Program actually began in the Department of Public Health in 1915, so 99 years ago. It was the Division of Sanitary Engineers, and it had a division chief named Chester Gillespie for 31 years. It started with three sanitary engineers, and they started doing inspections of drinking water systems. On July 1st, 2014, our Division of Drinking Water was transferred to the State Board, which included 291 positions. And we received a new deputy director, Cindy Forbes. She was a Southern California branch chief, and she's been working with the drinking water program her entire career of 35 years. The official transfer was approved via the governor's budget, and the governor wanted to establish a single water quality agency to enhance the accountability for water quality issues from, you know, the start to the finish to drinking water. The Division of Drinking Water's responsibilities are the enforcement of the federal and Safe Drinking Water Acts. The state has delegated primacy from the EPA to regulate the water systems. We also delegate our responsibility to some counties, which I'll go over in a second. We oversee nearly 8,000 water systems in the state that serve 38 million people. There's 3,000 plus community water systems. And there's about 4,500 non-community water systems. And non-community water systems are water systems where people don't live. So it's like a school, a business, a state park, a campground, something like that, where people visit every day, but they don't live there. A public water system, the definition of a public water system, which is kind of important, it serves 25 people at least 60 days a year. So that's its only criteria, 25 people, 60 days a year. Systems that serve greater than 1,000 service connections, and I know there was another stat that was given, but there's only 700 systems that serve greater than 1,000 service connections, which is not a very big system. And that serves 98% of the population. So there's these, you know, 3,000 plus water systems that serve a very small amount of the population. Of the 291 staff that move, about 200 of them work in the field offices. We have 23 local field offices, which we actually got a couple of new positions, and we're going to create a 24th in the Fresno office. And we're separated into five regions. So the map I gave you, your region is actually split into two of our regions. We are split up by counties. So my region's down here at the bottom, and we have Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County, which is under your jurisdiction. Above in the yellow region is Stefan Kahina, is my counterpart in Richmond. He's the section chief in Richmond. And the district engineers in Monterey is Jan Swigert. And then you also have a little bit of Santa Clara County, which is Eric Lacey. Eric Lacey's in our Richmond office. Jan Swigert is in a Monterey office. And then my office in Santa Barbara is district engineer. Their supervisor is Jeff Densmore. And he would have been with me here today, but he's on vacation. Each district office has four or five engineers, a data technician, and an office tech. That's kind of how we've designed each of our offices. Their main responsibility is the enforcement of the Safe Drinking Water Act and regulations. We issue permits to all drinking water systems for any new source, treatment facility, storage tank or major distribution system. We also hold a permit over the whole water system, which we try to update every 10 years. Another large part of our program is sanitary surveys or inspections of the system. It's a comprehensive 8-element EPA regulated type of sanitary survey. We do those every 3 years on community water systems and every 5 years on non-community water systems. Our offices collect all the monthly drinking water, monthly, quarterly, and annual drinking water quality reports from the water system. Every treatment plant and every distribution system of every one of those systems has to send us some kind of monthly report, which is reviewed and logged into our databases. Our offices are also responsible for recycled water projects, funding projects. We help with our headquarters office. We're also on our internal drought task force teams. We have a various number of internal committees, and all of our engineers and staff are considered first responders to emergencies, and we do a lot of response on fires, earthquakes, stuff like that. Now, the delegation to us from the EPA for the drinking water program, we also delegate to counties. 30 counties have been delegated the authority to regulate small water systems, which are non-community water systems or systems that serve less than 200 service connections. So 30 of the 58 have delegation agreements. In your area, Santa Barbara County, which has about 100 systems, San Luis Obispo County, which has about 100 systems, Monterey County, which has 290 systems, and Santa Cruz County, which has 85 water systems, are all delegated counties. So they have the responsibility to regulate those small water systems within their county. We are considered their technical assistants. We help them with any engineering. They usually do not employ engineers. They employ environmental scientists, environmental health specialists. So when treatment things come up, we are their technical assistants. And we also do annual reviews of their program. Other programs that transferred to the state board, we have a northern branch, a southern branch, which is under Cindy. And then we also have a program management branch, which takes care of statewide issues. Within that branch, we have a small water systems unit, which works directly with our LPAs, our county delegated programs. We have a regulatory development section, which sets our water quality standards. We have technical specialists for advanced treatment, such as UV, membrane treatment, things like that. We have a recycled water unit. We also have a SIDWISH unit, which is our EPA reporting requirement. We have a whole unit that has to take care of our reporting to the EPA. We have Water Security Division. We have a device certification program. And also transferred with us was the ELAP program, which is the Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program. They certify the laboratories in California. So that program was also transferred. Programs that also moved within our division but aren't in the drinking water program, isn't in the Division of Drinking Water, is all of our funding people. They were put in the Division of Financial Assistance. So we combined with them. Our operator certification units combined, and so did some of our administrative and IT staff. Some notable issues. We have a drought. We've been talking about that a lot. We spend a lot of time on it. There's a new Chrome 6 standard. It's 10 parts per billion. And in your area, the Santa Ynez Valley has Chrome 6 naturally occurring. There will be several water systems in that area that will not comply with the Chrome 6 standard. We are already beginning discussions with them. We have in this area some arsenic and nitrate violations, usually small systems. And overall, the small system compliance cost is such an issue. We have a lot of funding mechanisms. We can buy somebody a treatment plant. That's not a big deal. The problem is them being able to sustain it for years to come. The operating of these treatment facilities usually is more than the budget of the water system that we want to put a water treatment plant in. So a lot of times their fees have to double or triple just to operate the treatment facility, mainly because if you take arsenic out, you have a hazardous waste. You take nitrate out, you have a brine, so you have something to get rid of. Some collaboration things that we've been working on. Dr. Hunter mentioned the smart water RO systems from Dr. Cohen. I visited their Port Hueneme demonstration facility, and I've met with him a couple of times about that. I'm also chair of the Water Treatment Committee, which is an internal committee of ours that deals with advanced and new treatment technologies. So I met with him. We do have some biological treatment that we have worked with the city of Delano on a demonstration project. There's also one in West Valley in the Riverside area. Both of them are full-scale projects that are, Delano's not completed yet, but West Valley has completed construction. It's actually operating. So, and they are running it right now to try to determine how well it works and to complete our permit. Also, things that we're working on, it was mentioned Cambria Community Services District Groundwater Recharge Project. The Monterey Regional Water Pollution Control Agency also has a groundwater recharge project that we've been meeting with some of the staff and Monterey Regional. There are a couple of desal projects that we're starting to work on. The Monterey Cal-Am project is still underway, and the Santa Barbara project that was mentioned. We've met with the city of Santa Barbara a couple times about a proposed design. So thank you very much for having me today. It's been a great first month with the board. The board staff has been very helpful and welcoming to us. They've helped us learn a lot of new things that we have to do going from one agency to another. You know, I tell everybody the first day, I'm glad my computer turned on, but a couple days after it didn't, and we had to reset some stuff because we had to change all of our servers, and we're still working on that. But it's been a very good first month, and appreciate coming, and I could answer any questions if you have any.
Well, welcome, and thank you for the introductions of your organization. Mr. Young.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. Good morning. How close are we to the widespread use of reclaimed water going directly into an aquifer groundwater supply?
For a groundwater recharge type of project?
Yeah, I mean.
So our regulations are completed. So they were completed June 18th, 2014. So the process now becomes much simpler. Before, we had a little one paragraph reg, which we had to do a lot of work to get to that point. But now with the regulation, people know exactly what they have to put in to get there. I think personally the groundwater recharge to have sustainability is a local's way to go, because you have not only good treatment, but you also have an environmental buffer of, you know, cleaning the water and time to react if there is an issue. So a good groundwater basin with a good groundwater recharge project is probably the best way to sustain your groundwater structure. The one problem is cost. And it's not necessarily the treatment and monitoring. A lot of the cost is the wastewater plants over here and up the hill is where you got to put the water. So there's usually a large distance and a lot of land you need to do such a project, and a lot of systems don't have that type of thing. Cambria, for instance, is putting in an advanced treatment plant. They're lucky. They own from the perk ponds to their wells, so they can put stuff in there. If they didn't, they'd probably never have a project. They would have had to do something else. So that's a difficult thing. Also, a lot of our funding, I don't know about the funding that you were talking about, recycled, a lot of the funding doesn't allow you to buy property. That's an exclusion in a lot of funding things, which makes it difficult. Is that?
That answers my question pretty much. And then under the new regs, is it possible to actually drink water that's coming right out of a reclamation plant connected to a sewage treatment plant?
Okay, that's considered direct potable reuse.
Yeah.
So we're talking about indirect.
Right.
We have indirect regs. The direct potable reuse, we have an expert panel, which was part of SB 918, and it has been put together. They've had one meeting, and they are looking at two things: surface water augmentation, which means putting the water into a lake, and direct potable reuse. What they're supposed to come up with in the next 18 months is it feasible with the technology we have now to write a regulation? That is their charge. So they're supposed to look at how you monitor and how you treat water can you put all that together and come up with a reg? If they say it's feasible, then they will put together an outline how we will write a regulation. They're supposed to be done before 2016. Now, there are a couple of places that pseudo kind of do it, you know, in Texas. Big Springs, Texas has a plant. They actually take wastewater, they treat it, they put it in a pipeline that comes from a lake to a surface water treatment plant, and they blend it. And then it goes to the surface water treatment plant, which is then taken to drink. So there's no environmental barrier. There's only two treatment plants. There's also another place in Texas, and name escape, Wichita Falls, I think. Yeah, that one's being constructed right now. And there's various groundwater recharge projects throughout the nation. But actually drinking it yet, there's no regulation in any state. And are we going to get there? Is that what you're asking me? We are going to get there.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's in process.
Yes.
At least we're looking at it. Now, is there discussion as part of this direct use looking at the chemicals of emerging concern? Steve,
yeah.
What's the acronym for that?
CECs.
Yeah. Those, I mean, you know, we don't look at pharmaceutical levels in waste.
Right.
We don't look at a lot of things. So does this new paradigm consider actually looking at those other components that we have just historically not bothered to take a look at because we're just disposing it as waste?
Right. So that is part of the experts panel, what they're looking at. It's also part of our groundwater recharge reg. We have a specific section which deals with CECs, and you have to provide a certain amount of treatment for it. We now require for an injection project like Cambria has a reverse osmosis and an advanced oxidation process, which anything that can squeak through an RO process kind of gets destroyed by the AOP, mm-hmm. and then it's kind of absorbed in the ground. So there are some very good techniques on how to remove that type. I've heard a lot of people talk about direct potable reuse, and most people say the technology is available to provide water to the community that is healthy for the long term. Taking wastewater. The issue is the operation and maintenance and monitoring of it for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, putting it in a lab and making it, you can make great water. Mm-hmm. But to give it to a water system for 20 years and them to continue to produce the same quality of water day after day after day, which if you mess up for 5 minutes, somebody drinks it type of thing, that's the main concern of what the expert panel's looking at. Like I said, I've done this for 25 years. After a treatment plant's been around for 10 or 15 years, it looks a lot different. It operates a lot different. And that's the part when I talk to professors about, oh, you can do it. I say, have you ever been to a treatment plant that's 20 years old? You know, some are good and some you wonder about. So that's my concern.
So are we talking about establishing certain water quality standards
yeah.
for things like pharmaceuticals? I mean, is there a acceptable amount that
someday
would be
I'm sure, but right now we talk about a treatment technique. So we have an advanced oxidation process which does a very good job, and we require it to be operated at a certain dose, and so it puts out a certain amount of power to knock out those things. It's very difficult to monitor in and out because realistically the CECs come and go depending on, you know, what's going on. So we are looking more at a treatment technique type of thing.
Okay, but what's on the other end? I mean, you've done your treatment. Is there testing?
Yeah, we still test.
Contemplated to make sure that
right.
the...
Right, we test once a year. Our groundwater recharge requirements require pharmaceuticals and CECs to be tested once a year.
And is there any allowable level?
No. There's no levels out there right now. There's just some... You know, some professors have come up with some levels which they feel are adequate, but there's no regulatory levels.
Okay, thank you.
I think Mr. Johnston had a question, and then Dr. Hunter.
Yes, on the chromium 6, I've been hearing about it in Watsonville where I live. I understand that it's an issue there. And what's the timeline for water systems to get that together, number one, and number two, is there financial assistance for low-income communities? I'm not quite sure how that's defined.
Yeah, so we do have the State Revolving Fund program has grant money for disadvantaged communities. So there is grant and loan money through the SRF program. There's no separate program at this point for specifically CRUM 6 within our jurisdiction. The timeline is July 1st, 2014, the regulation became a reg. You have until January 1st, 2015 to take your initial sample. So you have 6 months. Within that 6 months, if you take your initial sample and it's over the MCL, you have to start quarterly monitoring. And as you go through your quarterly monitoring, if you exceed 10 on an annual average, then you would be an exceedance. If you are an exceedance, you have two choices. You either take the source offline, or if you can't, you have to do public notification, and then we work with you on a plan and time schedule to come up to get treatment. We would also work with you with funding if that was needed.
Okay, and I have a second question, which is, you were talking about 38 million people on the 3,000 plus systems, and those are systems 25 connections and more. Is that correct?
I believe so, because the private systems only serve, you know, a million or two people. I've read
that was my question, because that's a target that we're chasing here, as we are looking at nitrate contamination in groundwater. It's just always hard for me to get a sense as to the size of the population that's served by those wells, or that's served by those systems that are under the radar, as it were, that are under that 25 connection level.
Right, so the private wells are very difficult to calculate how many people, but I think I read somewhere, it was somewhere between 1 and 2 million people are on either private wells or very small systems.
And it would be a stab in the dark to ask if you have a guess as to how many are in our region.
Yeah, that would be a stab in the dark. I wouldn't know, sorry.
All right, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Souza. So pleased to meet you and to understand the resources that the transfer over to this drinking water division, what the resources are coming into the program. You mentioned Mr. Young raised the issue of pharmaceuticals. And I am a member of the Carmel River Watershed Conservancy. And for the last 3 years, we have been working actively with CalAm in particular, but other community businesses in developing a model for program for drug collection system so that people, there's various ways in which pharmaceuticals end up in the waste stream. One of them is just simply people disposing them into the water system. And it's taken about 3 years to get to the point where we have now the network set up and different facilities, including police stations and other locations that are certified to handle these controlled substances. So my question for you is, this is an important issue in the Carmel Valley because there are septic systems, and so that, you know, there's a number of things that they're looking at in protecting the groundwater basin there. But my question to you is there money available to support more programs like this? Because it was a real heavy lift, and this is a small area, but a critical one, facing, water shortages, where the Carmel River, of course, is the water supply for Monterey region, the greater Monterey region. So, we're always interested in finding out if there is money available to develop these types of programs.
So I'd have to say I don't know of a specific program, but I'll tell you this. In our groundwater recharge regs, it requires a source control program, and mm-hmm. there's six elements that you have to do. Mm-hmm. And the project proponents who have done this in the past, one of the programs is what you're talking about, trying to get the drugs out of dumping them down the drain. Mm-hmm. And there's a variety of sanitary districts that have, you know, different flyers, and they put them on their bills or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the ones that do the groundwater recharge, the indirect potable reuse, they specifically spend more time and money, you know, doing that. I would assume that if someone took out a loan, one of this $800 million that we talked about, to do a groundwater recharge project, that that could be a component of the project, since it is in our regulations that you have to do it. Mm. So it, I assume that it could be taken as part of that, because all the design to get to the point to put in the system is usually considered eligible, and this would be one of the programs that they would have to implement to have a project.
So on that same track, is there any effort or any of the divisions and subdivisions, anybody working on regulations for emerging contaminants?
Personally, I don't know of any.
Okay. So my last question is really a broad one, because you outlined a great range of activities and expertise that now come into the State Board program. And I'm wondering, in your view, because you have been involved with the DPH for so long, what are the big benefits here that we think we're going to see with this transition? That would be one thing. And second, where are we in the process of putting this information out, both through the web or working through water companies, water purveyors, to get the information out that, you know, where the changes are occurring, what access points there are for taking advantage of where small communities could use your assistance, could use support programs that you mentioned today are pretty remarkable.
So the collaboration effort, this is one of our ideas that we're going to come to each of the 9 boards and do what I'm doing today, basically. So, and I know that that was asked through Tom Howard and the State Board. Mm-hmm. So we're reaching out to the regional boards in this way. How we reach out to the water systems, we do have within our funding unit some, you know, ways that we do send flyers out and stuff. We also have what's called, it escapes me now, but it's a funding fair. Yeah, the funding fair. Mm-hmm. And we participate with DWR, State Board, and 3 or 4 other agencies, USDA, I think, and they have 4 or 5 locations, and they mix them up around the California year. It's a 1-day program. We're in the morning, each agency gives like a 30-minute talk about what kind of money they have, and in the afternoon, they all sit at a table, different table, and you can walk up and tell them your project and ask them. I've been to a couple of them before. A lot of small water systems come to that. They bring their project, you know, and they kind of go from table to table, and someone will say, hey, I can, you know, help you with this. There's also an application on the Funding Fair's website. It's just 1 page. It gets sent to all the agencies, and then if you can help them, you're supposed to contact them. Mm-hmm. So that's one of our biggest ways to kind of get the word out.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yes, Mayor Delgado.
All right. Thank you, Kurt, for all your information today and being here. Kind of a big picture question. You were discussing desalinization and groundwater recharge efforts earlier. And my big picture question is, as new desal facilities come online and sort of help out with the supply side of things, do you foresee that there'll just be more demand because with more water supply, there'll be more projects approved for growth to handle, you know, all the mandatory housing requirements and everything and the growth of population as it continues. So do you see there being a solution in these desal and groundwater recharge, or do you see that we have to do that, it's the best thing we can do, but in the long run, there'll just be more demand and the shortage will continue?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, I think it depends on each water system's, you know, long-term forecasts and what they do with it. Number one, like, let's just say the city of Santa Barbara built a desal plant. It's going to cost $1,500 an acre foot. They can get water from Lake Chuma for like $300 an acre foot. So just the sheer cost would be prohibited to use all the time. If the lake's full, they're going to only use it, you know, they're just going to keep it operating. They're not going to use it all the time. So I think each system will kind of manage that resource in its own way. I guess if you built a groundwater recharge project, depending on how you build it, you may use that more often or on a continual basis. But I think each water system really would have to look at their long-term forecast and how big of something they build and how they would manage that. But I think you're right. Some systems will build it, and then they will consider that plus whatever they used to have and start building, you know, start expanding, and then they'll be back right where they were again. And that's happened before. You know, you get another source from somebody, and then pretty soon that's just part of your portfolio, and you build out to that. So when the drought comes, you don't really have a, quote, drought buffer. So I think every water system has to manage that on their own. And that's one thing that our office, we talk to water systems about, but we're more water quality people as opposed to quantity. We don't really get into that as much.
Okay. My next and only other question regards your comments about the lack of ability to maintain a facility in the long run, and that the capital expenditures to do that are somewhat prohibitive. Not that the technology is not there, but the financial resources to maintain it. And what you didn't mention was public reluctance, public perception. And until today, I always thought that was the major barrier to more direct potable uses of treated wastewater.
You'd be surprised how many meetings I've gone to where the health aspect of something like that doesn't come up as much anymore. I think 20 years ago, you know, 90% of the people in a board meeting would want to come up to the microphone and say, there's no way I'm drinking that. But now I think only 5% of the people say that. We went to the Cambria board meeting. There was over 100 people there. Not one person said that they didn't think the water was going to be healthy to drink. I was there to answer those questions. I never got out of my chair. No one ever asked. They wanted to know how much it cost, and they wanted to know about the evaporation pond, if it was going to stink. It was the two main concerns. It was there with me trying to help out. So, I mean, there's not, I don't think, especially in a drought, there's not as many questions about that. There still are people that, you know, don't think that we should recycle water, but I think the number is much smaller. Now, direct potable reuse may be a different obstacle.
Which use?
Direct potable, when they're not saying we're putting it in the ground or we're going to put it in a reservoir or something like that.
Right, that was my question.
That may be a little different, but actually in the Cambria meeting, a guy stood up and said, I can't believe we're building this plant and putting it back in the ground. We should just put it in our distribution system. And a few people kind of laughed at him, but there wasn't like an outcry to yell at him to sit down or anything.
Now, on my honeymoon, I went to the Orange County treatment plant, and on those tours, high schoolers and everybody else, they drink that water directly.
Right.
And I guess what you're saying is it's a big leap having that available to visitors versus putting it directly into a public distribution system, and if something were to go wrong without the environmental barrier, you could have a lot of sick people. So is that true that it's a big leap between letting anyone come and drink the water versus putting it in a system of distribution?
So there's two leaps. One is you just take a little bit and drink it. So long-term health effects of chemicals are thrown out the door. That doesn't cause anything. The second leap is you went to Orange County Water District. You saw that place. I mean, you could eat off the floor. You know, it's very, very well maintained. They spend a ton of money keeping that up. Their entire business is to make sure that thing runs. My fear is not Orange County or West Basin or LADWP who's going to spend millions of dollars to keep it up. Once you make a reg, anybody can have a direct potable reuse plant. You know, Little Cambria or Cayucas or somebody like that could build one, a little half million gallon a day plant, and it could run for 20 years. Those are the ones that worry me the most, because those are the little surface water treatment plants or the little arsenic plants or the little nitrate plants that we go and see that, you know, we're on people about trying to maintain and trying to put more money into it. And that's when you have issues.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's my candid answer. That's not the answer of the state board.
And Mr. Harris, I think you had a question. And I will not ask Mayor Delgado how many years he's been married.
The issues surrounding recycled water and also direct reuse, I think the technology is the easy part, at least on the drinking water side. The one that we're more challenged with, and we are with Cambria, is what do you do with the reverse osmosis reject water? Because now you have a waste that you have to deal with. And that's what we are currently struggling with, is trying to figure out how we are going to permit it. One is, does it go into the pond? We're getting a lot of opposition from parks and other people on that. The problem with it, the source that they have is when they run it through RO, it concentrates the metals, and that's where we're struggling with how to deal with the metals. It's limiting our options right now. We've been working with the state board and of course, with Kurt, but that's our biggest challenge, and you're going to have that challenge with all of these projects. Finally, if we're done with this item, Mr. Chair, if we wanted to take a break, but before we do, I just want to, and thank you very much, Kurt.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, we are getting behind on time. We have some very strict time limits today. So what I would suggest is after the break, come back and do the uncontested. I would suggest we skip the TMDL item. There just isn't time for that today. And then go into the C-camp for just a short period of time and try to get through that so we can get on with the item at approximately 11 o'clock.
Yes, and we'll take a 15-minute break, and we will reconvene at 10 to 11. Okay. Thank you.
Chair Wolf, may I just acknowledge Chris Rose, who has been in place and ready to make his update report to the board, and this is the second time he's been postponed, and so we are looking forward to that, Chris. We all value the TMDL program.
Well, Chris is... Chris is no longer the TMDL program manager. He's the Ag program manager now. So, you know, he's a carryover at this point.
Oh, I see. Anyway,
thank
I just want to acknowledge